As Nagarjuna has said in his precious garland, that if you want to have happiness for yourself and for others, the root is the development of bodhicitta. And likewise, you should develop a compassion which embraces the well-being of all sentient beings. And even though we have a number of afflictive emotions and seeds and imprints of these afflictive emotions, they can be eliminated. And likewise, with regard to the development of positive qualities like the 10 powers of the Buddha and so on, these we have the potential to develop these qualities. Therefore, in order to actualize such a state of enlightenment, we have the practice of bodhicitta and the view of emptiness. So these are said to be the main sources of actualization of Buddhahood. The teaching of the Buddha was transmitted through Nagarjuna and so on, and thus a great number of practitioners have been produced, and these great masters have given and faultless teachings, and in Tibet all the great Tibetan schools of thought trace their origin in the teaching of these Nalanda masters, and therefore even today we have the perfect lineage of all those transmissions, and there is still the living tradition of adopting them and practicing them in our own life. And through developing such spiritual realizations and grounds, there are people who have achieved high realizations, even though you may not be able to pinpoint these people publicly. And you can at least notice that these long-time practitioners, because of their continuous practice, they were able to develop much more disciplined state of mind. And because of this, they were able to bring much happiness within oneself and in the mind of many other people. And therefore, when we talk about engaging in Dharma practice, we are doing so for our own personal well-being and benefit. And the experience of happiness and suffering is very much related to transforming and changing the attitude. And therefore, with regard to the Mahayana teaching and practices, there is a number of techniques and practices by which you can transform and change your mind. So it is not the case that you have to just force yourself adopting just one course of practice, but there are a number of ways and methods to change and transform your mind. Therefore, all of us, oneself and others, all of us should, if you are someone who really wants to have a peaceful mind, a disciplined state of mind, then it is worthwhile to make an attempt to understand this profound and vast teaching of the Buddha which has flourished in Tibet. Because if you study and reflect on them, you will find there is much more scope to undertake a detailed analysis and thereby to transform our mind. Therefore, we should all feel fortunate and privileged that we have such an opportunity to listen and study such a text. And as I have just cited the words from the precious garland from Nagarjuna, that what we are studying here is primarily how to develop and how to practice, on the one hand, the altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, and on the other hand, the wisdom realizing emptiness. And of course, such texts on mind training, they also are kind of stages of the path, which explains the whole process of stages of the path. But they primarily focus on the development of bodhicitta and wisdom understanding emptiness. And in terms of the lineage, in terms of the distant lineage, the lineage comes right from the Buddha. And in terms, I would say, closer lineage, then it comes from Maitreya and then down to Shantideva. And Therefore, all the texts on mind training primarily have their source, of course, to the teaching of the Buddha, then to the teaching of Shantideva, like his text, Bodhicharya Avatara. And in fact, we have briefly read about this lineage masters yesterday, like Rakshidharma, Rakshita, and so on. And I have here a manuscript on mind training, which is said to be composed by Geshe Chegawa. And this is a kind of new information, so I would read it. In the teaching of the Buddha, there are two categories, Hinayana and Mahayana teachings, and within Mahayana there is the Sutric teachings and the Tantric teachings. And Atishakya is the three lineages. First of all, the lineage comes from Dharmarakshita, and he was someone who was a great bodhisattva, who was even able to offer the part of his body, part of his flesh. So he was a great perfected master, but in terms of his philosophy, he was follower of Vaibhashika, and therefore Atishas and he said, therefore Atisha says, even though he has a kind of inferior philosophy, but in terms of his practice, the later part of his life, he even chopped a part of his flesh from the thigh and offered to someone who was in need. And because of coming together of certain external and internal factors, gradually he embraced the Mahayana viewpoint. And therefore, I think he says, even if you have such a kind of lower philosophical viewpoint, but because of your such a practice, you can understand the Mahamudra, the higher view. And then the second lineage is from Chamben Nenjor. This master, Lama Chamben Nenjor, and according to some texts, they say this Lama Chamben Nenjor and Kusumba, they are different, and some texts they say they are same. And he got this name Chamben Nenjor, meditator on love, because he was always meditating on love. And in the profound lineage, we talk about two Kusali masters, and the greater or the senior Kusali master followed the Chandrakirti's viewpoint. And he followed the non-abiding philosophical viewpoint. And in terms of the scripture, he follows the Agashgarbha Sutra. And he follows Shiksha Samuchya and Shantideva's Bodhicharya Avatara. The third lineage master is the Selingpa, and according to his philosophy, so here in this text it says, according to this philosophical viewpoint, without eliminating the grasping and the view of the self, what is well known is this master is said to be the follower of the mind-only school of thought. And since Atisha practiced the Madhyamika viewpoint, he even, because of this, Lama Selingpa used to tell Atisha that he is a nihilistic because he followed the Prasangika Madhyamika viewpoint. So in this text it says that according to Lama Selingpa's viewpoint, without eliminating the self-grasping, they would embrace the philosophy of self-grasping, they accept a kind of existence of a self, which is common to the notion of certain non-Buddhist schools of thought. So this is a kind of new information to me. And in terms of logic, he followed the lineage that comes from Maitreya. And And this particular instruction is the instruction that primarily comes from Lama Selimpa. And then there is also a quotation from a sutra called the Stainless Sutra, where it says the grasping of the self, grasping of the psychophysical aggregate is said to be the source of production of the Buddha. So according to this philosophy, they would accept or take it for granted the existence of a self, which is continuous, permanent, and just accepting that self, an explanation is made by saying that all are same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, and through that way a path is shown to achieve enlightenment. So this is a kind of new information. And in fact, in order to accept this philosophical viewpoint, it is said that just as a lotus flower is born in a muddy place and not in a dry place, so similarly, the actualization of Buddhahood is possible by maintaining the self and not denying it. So it has its own kind of beauty, its own way of. So, and particularly when it is said that this view of the self is common to the non-Buddhist schools of thought, then clearly saying that a self which is permanent, partless, and all-pervading is accepted. Lama Rendawa, who had taught Madhyamika viewpoint to Atisha, he accepted a conventional self. So even though according to Khyutub Rinpoche, both Atisha and his teacher Rendawa, they had same viewpoint. This is important to know because sometimes people make the mistake by not being able to understand the meaning and by simply following the word, and they would say Rendawa, Tsongkhapa's master, accepted a self, whereas Tsongkhapa denied it. So even though there may be differences in usage of the terms, but the main focus and thrust may be the same. So this is just what I wanted to inform you. And the title of this text says that this is composed by Chekawa. And according to this text, it says, it seems that Chekawa himself had composed the root text and then later on also written a. But I do not know. My main point is that all this mind-training teachings have their source in the Bodhicharya Avatara. So we'll read from the Bodhicharya Avatara to start with. It should be verse number 4 according to your English translation, but I'm reading from the Tibetan text. The verse number 4 says that this human life with endowments and leisure is extremely difficult to find, and having found this opportunity to fulfill the meaning of a human being, if you do not bring about some benefit, and then it will be difficult to actualize such a human life in the future. As is said in other text, that in terms of development of and powerful being,
and
You hear me now? Yeah, okay. Sorry. So in terms of development of a powerful bodhicitta, there is no life as conducive as the life of a human being. It is on the basis of a human life, and particularly from the point of view that human beings possess such a great human intelligence that we have the capacity to develop marvelous qualities like infinite altruism in the form of bodhicitta, which is an altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, and likewise the development of wisdom, understanding, emptiness. All this is possible in the life of a human being and not in the life of an animal. And fortunately today we have access to such a precious Dharma teaching, and we also have access to necessary external and internal facilities, and that is why this human life has been termed as one which has freedom and which has certain endowments. And particularly among the human population, if you reflect carefully, not all of the human lives have such a conducive factor for undertaking Dharma practice. And as it will be explained in detail in the mind tending like the rest of the sun, this human life is said to be a life with leisure because you have time to undertake certain spiritual practices. This is so because if you are influenced by certain hindrances and obstructions, then you have, of course, no leisure, no freedom. But when you are free from such obstructions and hindrances, then you have the leisure. And likewise, you also possess the endowment. The endowment here means you also possess certain, you are not only free from certain obstructions, but you also have certain necessary positive factors and positive conditions, and whether it is in terms of fulfillment of temporary needs or in terms of fulfillment of long-term benefits, human life has the capacity to do so. And also it is the law of nature that the more rare and the precious the fruit is, the more complex and good the cause also has to be. Therefore, since human life is so precious, so wonderful and so good, therefore this life, human life, cannot be obtained easily without ordinary causes and factors. And therefore, since your mind is not hidden to yourself, you must contemplate and reflect within, and then see whether you have the necessary factors within you or not, so that you will obtain such precious human life in the future or not. And therefore, it is said that this human life is extremely difficult to find. And so with the leisure and endowment, now today you have an opportunity to really fulfill the meaning of a human being. The human being or individual, the Sanskrit word, a counterpart for human being or individual here is Purush or Purukha or Purush. Purush, the Sanskrit or Hindi word Purush, means someone who has the capacity to bring about certain positive qualities. And so you have that potential and quality with that. And having found such a precious human life, but because of laziness and distraction, if you do not lead a way of life which will bring benefit for many lives to come or for long-lasting peace and happiness, and if you are unable to do that, and without fulfilling that, if you go empty-handed, if you waste your life, then in the future it will be extremely difficult to obtain such favorable factors and favorable conditions. So this explains the basis, the human life, based on which you can meditate on bodhicitta. Verse 5. Just as in the night, in the darkness, and within the dark clouds, when the lightning moves, and then for a moment you see some light, Now, so here it's a very interesting example is given. Out of the day and night, it's not day, it is, let us say, it is not day, it is night. And not only it is night, but it is extremely dark. And not only dark, the sky is overcast with thick clouds, thick dark clouds. And within that, if there is a lightning, then because of this lightning, just for a brief moment, you will get some light. And because of this light, you will get a brief glimpse of objects like the physical form and so on. And similarly, due to the power of the Buddha, and because of the power of the Buddha and because of one's own having accumulated merit in the past, very rarely and for a brief moment you are able to develop certain positive intelligence, positive wisdom. So because of the power of the Buddha and your having accumulated merit, the worldly beings very rarely and briefly are able to develop some positive wisdom, positive intelligence. And now the text says very rarely and briefly we are able to develop certain positive thoughts because our mind is very habituated and very familiar with negative emotions, whereas our mind is not habituated with the positive emotions and positive qualities. So therefore, depending upon factors, very rarely and briefly we are able to develop certain wisdoms, certain positive thoughts. However, today we have found this precious human life, we have faith and devotion to the teaching of the Buddha, we are born in a place where there is practice of Buddha Dharma, and for example, here we are talking about bodhicitta that cherishes the well-being of other sentient beings. We are able to at least hear such wonderful qualities, and not only you are able to hear, but you also have some sense of appreciation and interest towards such positive qualities, and you also have access to such wonderful teachers and texts that explains these positive virtuous practices. So to obtain such an opportunity is nearly possible. It's extremely difficult and very rare to find it. And therefore, the faith that you have towards Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and the compassion that you have towards all sentient beings, these are the facilitating factors for the development of bodhicitta. However, it is not easy to develop these qualities, and since it will not be possible to get such an opportunity again and again, and since we have such an opportunity today, it is extremely important to use this opportunity and to make an effort to develop these qualities. Verse 6. In this way, you should realize that human life is extremely difficult to find. And having found, even if you have found human life, it will be also difficult to develop positive qualities like compassion, faith towards Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, which are the foundations for the development of bodhicitta. And therefore, development of virtuous qualities are very difficult. And even when we develop certain virtuous qualities, they are very fragile and they are very weak and not very strong. So whether it is whether it's a virtuous deed or a non-virtuous deed, if it is done with strong motivation and a strong application and practice and a strong conclusion, then that virtuous and non-virtuous deeds become very powerful. Now, in our case, in the case of some negative emotions, we first, for example, we develop first of all very strong motivation to kill an insect. For example, if a mosquito comes to bite you, and particularly when your mood is not so good, when the mosquito visits you for the first time, then you will slave in and kill it. And if your mood is good, then during the first visit, you may develop some kind of empathy, some kind of compassion. And during the second visit, you get a little bit irritated. And still, you will be trying to make an attempt to follow the path of none. The third visit, then probably you will celebrate it and squash it. So what I'm trying to say is, when you do certain negative emotions with strong motivation, then strong application and practice, and then finally you enjoy as if you have destroyed the sworn enemy, then you commit a very strong negative deed. And in the beginning you can clearly see that you have the difficulty of not being able to catch the mosquito, and you make every attempt to corner it and kill it. And for example, in the case when you had a very disturbed sleep because of the mosquito, and finally if you are able to catch it and kill it, then you might feel completely relaxed and rejoice at the deed that you have done, thinking that now I can have a wonderful sleep. So this is how we do when it comes to performing certain negative actions. So in terms of killing insect and so on, the motivation is strong, and during the actual practice, during the actual application, you make every attempt, and particularly if the object is like a human being, then not only you kill it when you don't like somebody, you not only kill it, but you will try to eliminate or kill that person by making him or her suffer the most in most horrible ways. That is what we see in the during the war and so on. Killing, you try to bring the bring all types of pains and sufferings, and then in the finally you will enjoy, and in fact you will make a display of it and talking to your friend saying that finally I am able to eliminate my enemy, I have killed him or her. So the preparation is good, actual application is wonderful, very powerful, and the conclusion is again very powerful because you have rejoiced with your achievement. So the preparation, actual and conclusion, they are all powerful. And in the end, in the conclusion, if you, for example, regret, then it's slightly better. However, in the case of some virtuous deeds, even if you're asked to perform certain virtuous deeds, then you will feel it as if you're being forced by somebody, and you're very reluctant to engage in any kind of virtuous deeds. And so the motivation is not strong, and the actual practice is not strong. And even if the motivation is strong and the actual practice is strong, then in the end, instead of dedicating it nicely, you might become competitive and you might become arrogant, and you might become, you will use this as a tool to make a display to others. And particularly if you read the Adverses of the Mind Training, he sums up the teaching on the Adverses of Mind Training by saying that all these practices should not be contaminated by eight worldly concerns. And this is important because sometimes when we engage in practice, for example, even if you are doing some recitation, you always expect some praise and the pat on the back from others. How nice he is, he is a good student, he is a good, he knows this prayer by heart. You need all these compliments from other people. And that's why one of the Kadamba masters says, if you recite the prayer quietly through your throat, then you are a real disciplined practitioner. So don't make a display of it. And that is why there are some practitioners who you will never find them doing any prayer, or and they would always find their heads closed, and when somebody goes to see them, then they would just greet them and say hello, and no, it will not make a display of their knowledge, understanding, and so on. Now, on the other hand, we do find some superficial practitioners who beat the drum and play the bell so strongly as if that will disturb the neighbor's peace. And they want to make all this kind of display, and they are actually wasting their life. So as it's very correctly said here, that in terms of virtuous deeds, they are very weak. Even in the case of a rigorous student, his whole study may be due to motivation, due to wrong motivation, out of competition, jealousy, And in the beginning, you have great difficulty not being able to know the text. And later on, you know the meaning a little bit. And then you develop jealousy and competition to others. And you become arrogant. So it is extremely important to judge yourself. And that is why one of the great bodhisattva, he very clearly says that in the form of a religious practitioner, you will end up doing irreligious practices. So in the case of virtuous deeds, they are very weak, very fragile. Either the motivation is not strong, or the actual practice is not strong, or the conclusion is not strong. In the case of non-virtuous deeds, the motivation is strong, the actual practice is strong, and conclusion is strong. Therefore, the only technique now to be able to make our virtuous practice meaningful is that you should force yourself to meditate on altruism, bodhicitta. Because this intolerable and inexhaustible, powerful negative deeds can be overcome only by the practice of bodhicitta and nothing else. Now, for example, this is similar to the case where we are trying to confront a very powerful enemy. And if you have a very powerful enemy, then you need powerful method, powerful techniques, either a very powerful technology or powerful weapon and so on. Apart from that, there's no way you can control or destroy that opponent. And similarly, in our case, if you look carefully in terms of the influence of the afflictive emotions, these afflictive emotions have totally influenced us externally, totally influenced us internally. And afflictive emotions are accumulated day and night, and even in the dream we develop these afflictive emotions, irrespective of whether the completion is done. And particularly when you wake up, you rejoice at some of these negative emotions that you have dreamt, then probably it again will become a very strong negative emotions. Now in the case of virtuous deeds, you may be reading a holy text, you are listening to the instructions of the teacher, you are making some effort, but still you are very reluctant, and therefore the virtuous deeds are fragile and very weak. And therefore, under such a situation, the only practice which is like a panacea that will cure all your negative deeds, practice which would help you accumulate vast merits during a short moment, and a practice which would remove all the negative emotions and overcome all these negative emotions, is the practice of bodhicitta. And therefore you must make your mind habituated with such altruistic practice. And worse, this being the case, the Buddhas who thought for many eons and contemplated what is it that is most beneficial to all sentient beings, all these Buddhas have found that it is only this altruistic bodhicitta which is beneficial to sentient beings. So all this Buddha, the past, unanimously agreed that it is the practice of bodhicitta in terms of removing the sufferings of sentient beings, in terms of making them meet with temporary and long-term happiness. The best is the practice of bodhicitta, and that's the meaning of this verse, which says that the Buddhas, after this bodhicitta as the only beneficial. Getting disconnected from there, maybe. It is this practice of bodhicitta which guides countless sentient beings to the supreme state of peace and happiness and in the most easy way. And it is by the practice of bodhicitta that temporarily you are able to actualize peace and happiness, and then actualize liberation, and then finally the supreme state of peace, which is enlightenment. Verse 8, those that desire to destroy the hundreds of sufferings of the samsara, and those that desire to eliminate the unhappinesses of sentient beings, and those that wishes to enjoy hundreds of peace and happiness, these people should never give up the practice of bodhicitta in terms of eliminating sufferings. So the fourth line is actually related to all the preceding three lines. So you should read it like this: those who want to remove hundreds of sufferings never give up bodhicitta, and those that want to remove unhappiness never give up bodhicitta, and those that want to enjoy peace and happiness never give up bodhicitta. And as is said in the Maitreya's prayer, that it is this practice of bodhicitta which stops the path to negative state of existence. And it is this practice of bodhicitta which shows the path to higher status. Since such a bodhicitta leads to the achievement of the highest enlightenment, Buddhahood, therefore one is able to easily and quickly accumulate merit and virtue. And of course it is not easy to develop such a bodhicitta, and once you develop such a bodhicitta, then you can quickly and easily purify the negative deeds, and very easily and quickly accumulate the virtuous deeds, virtuous practices. So development of bodhicitta is really like solution for all problems, for removing temporary unhappiness and also long-term unhappiness. And such an altruistic wish is appreciated not only by human beings but by even by animals. And who can find fault in such an altruistic wish? Now in the case of the view of emptiness, even though it is wonderful, it's very profound, but still there may be people who may not disagree with it, and there may be people who will misunderstand it and intentionally ignore the cause-effect relationship. And some people might fall into the extreme of nihilism, and it could therefore become a source of controversy, discussion. Whereas in the case of an altruistic wish, who will debate against it? Now in the case of view of emptiness, how this view of emptiness will benefit the animals? I think this will be of no benefit to the animals. Whereas in the case of altruistic wish, even the animals will appreciate it. So whether it is in terms of removing the suffering of suffering, which is removing the temporary suffering, or in terms of removing the suffering of change, whenever we encounter such problems, like suffering and suffering of change, if you are someone who is meditating on bodhicitta, you will not be overwhelmed and you will not be frightened by such sufferings within the samsara, within the cycle of existence. And so long as you have such an altruistic wish, whatever hardships you may have to encounter in order to help others, you will not feel reluctant or tired or exhausted. You will gladly embrace to such a job, such a work, just like a swan entering into the lotus field. And also it is the development of bodhicitta. So therefore those who wants to destroy hundreds of sufferings within the samsara, you must meditate on bodhicitta. And then in the case of other sentient beings, they have temporary unhappinesses and long-term unhappinesses. So if your wish is to remove their unpleasant experiences or unhappinesses, there also you should never give up the practice of bodhicitta. And also if you are someone who wants to enjoy all the excellences or pleasures or countless peace and happinesses within the samsara, there also you should not give up developing bodhicitta. And there are additional practice benefits of development of bodhicitta. At the very moment when you develop bodhicitta, even in the case of a very weak person who is fettered in the prison of samsara, even such a person will then get the title and the name of the child of Buddha, and such a person will then become the object of homage of the worldly beings and the gods. So at the very moment when you develop the conventional bodhicitta, then even if you are right now leading a very weak ordinary life, that means you may be someone who is still within the samsara and someone who is fettered and overwhelmed by the suffering of change and so on. But because of your having developed such a wonderful state of the mind, the bodhicitta, you will immediately be called by the title the child of Buddhas, and you will become an object of homage of worldly beings and the gods. And because when we talk about, when we identify someone as a bodhisattva is not recognized in terms of the size of the body or in terms of physical attraction and beauty, but in terms of mental qualities. So this is what explained in verse 9. Verse 10. So this impure human life that we have today, even though it is impure, but this impure human life can be transformed into the body of the Buddha when you develop the bodhicitta, which is really like an elixir that transforms grosser material substances into the gold. In this very state, in this very impure form of a human being, with impure human life, full of sufferings and so on, this impure suffering human life can be transformed into the body of the Buddha through the development and practice of bodhicitta. And therefore, such bodhicitta should be seen as the most important practice. Verse 11, the soul guide, that means Buddha, when he thoroughly examined with immeasurable intelligence, found this precious human life as the most precious. And therefore, those who wants to get separated from this state of migration, the cyclic existence, then you must stably hold this precious human mind. Because there is no other virtuous practice which can fulfill all your temporary and long-term peace and happiness. And therefore, the soul guide and the soul liberator, the Buddhas have seen this as the most important precious practice. And therefore, if you want to get liberated or freed from the state of migration, this state of wandering, which means the state of the six realms of cyclic existence, if you want to get rid of this, and then you must hold this bodhicitta firmly. And there are other benefits also. Verse 12, in the case of other religious practices, they are like a plantain tree, and once they produce the fruit, then they will not produce the fruit again. They come to an end. Now, for example, if you undertake a virtuous practice which is targeted towards actualizing good human life, then because of such a motivation, once you actualize such a human life, then the result comes to an end. And similarly, if it is another religious practice whose aim is to achieve freedom from samsara or liberation, then as because it has the virtuous practice has been dedicated for actualizing such a state of liberation, because of that, once you actualize such a state of liberation, the force of that virtuous practice comes to an end. And that's the meaning of how all other virtuous practices, like a planted tree, produced only one fruit and then come to an end. Whereas in the case of all other virtuous practices, which are influenced by bodhicitta, they are like celestial trees, that they will keep on producing fruit. And this is so because when we talk about development of bodhicitta, we develop a motivation that aspires to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And because of such a motivation, that until the space comes to an end, the fruit of that virtuous deed will never come to an end. Irrespective of whether you are able to deliver all sentient beings to the state of enlightenment or not, but because of your motivation, and even if you are performing just one virtuous deed, but you have done such a virtuous deed with a wish to help all sentient beings achieve enlightenment, because of the force of such a motivation, until all sentient beings achieve enlightenment, the result of your virtuous deeds will not be lost. Just as someone who has committed a very unbearable, horrendous, negative deed, then if that person who has committed such a horrendous, unbearable, negative deed, if he relies on the help of a more powerful and brave person, then that person can still be can remain without fear. For example, let us take the example of one criminal who might have committed a very horrendous negative deed, but somehow if he seeks the refuge of someone who is really powerful, then he can remain without fear. So similarly, even if you have committed a very strong negative deed, but later on if you train your mind in bodhicitta, then even those very deadly negative deeds that you might have committed, you can still get liberated from being born into a negative state of existence. Therefore, all those who are conscientious must practice such bodhicitta. By developing bodhicitta, just like the fire of the aeon, all the strong negative deeds will be burnt even within one moment. And the immeasurable benefits of such bodhicitta has been explained by the wise Maitreya to Sudana, Norzang. Just as, for example, when the light comes, then the darkness which might have been there for many countless eons, all this darkness will go away within one moment when the light comes. So similarly, all the negative deeds that you might have accumulated in the past can be eliminated with the development of bodhicitta. So these are the advantages and benefits of bodhicitta, and if you are able to develop such a bodhicitta once, then as the great Kadamba master used to say, that you must make an effort to develop bodhicitta, and once you are able to develop such a bodhicitta, it will take the responsibility of accumulating merit, purifying negative deeds, actualizing temporary happiness and long-term happiness. And therefore, in the praise to the bodhicitta, the late Kunlama Rinpoche also makes a similar comment, and also in many other instructions on bodhicitta, they say that when you engage into dharma practice, and particularly in the beginning, if you get discouraged, then it is a big obstruction. So therefore, such discouragement can be removed by meditating on bodhicitta. And later on, if you are able to instill certain courage, if you are able to achieve some success in your religious practice, then again you would become very arrogant and proud. And on the other hand, if you are someone who undertakes the development of bodhicitta, then such arrogance and pride and jealousy to others, all this will automatically cease and stop. So therefore, it's the bodhicitta that will come and help you on those times when you feel discouraged, and also will help you when you get very arrogant and proud. And so your practice of bodhicitta should be there when you are alive and successful, because if you undertake bodhisattva, bodhicitta practice, then that will ensure happiness in your life. And at the time of the death also, you should meditate on bodhicitta. That will ensure peaceful transition. And even during the intermediate state, meditate on bodhicitta. That will ensure you to achieve enlightenment in the future. And when you develop such an altruism, then you are able to see all sentient beings as your friends, as your relatives. So whatever be their reaction and behavior, you will also always be able to maintain that kind of closeness towards others. And from the depth of one's heart, when one develops a strong feeling of closeness to everybody, including one's own enemies, then that will be the guarantee for peace and happiness in the long run. Contrarily, if you simply use physical power to eliminate your opponent or your enemies, it will be an impossible task. And therefore, in one of the texts, it says that however powerful an army general you are or a king you are, if there is no army general or no king who said that I have destroyed all my enemies and now I can die peacefully, because external enemies will just keep on coming. So they cannot be eliminated through their physical destruction. So these are some of the advantages and benefits of development of bodhicitta. And if you want to know more, then you should read this text called Gandharva Sutra, where the intelligent Maitreya explains all these benefits to Sudana. Now we read from the other text, Maintaining Like the Rays of the Sun. The second point says that in order to develop veneration and respect to the instruction, the specific greatness of the instructions are being taught here, which is the uncommon or special functions. In terms of the greatness of the texts of the maintaining, from the 7 points of maintaining, it says that it's like a diamond, it's like a sun, and like a celestial tree. So you should understand the meaning of the scripture like a diamond, like a sun, and like a celestial tree. And the signs of the five signs of degeneration of time are transformed into the path of the bodhicitta, path of enlightenment. Now, how this instruction on maintaining is like a diamond or vajra, and if you possess What need is there to talk about being able to eliminate the complete power tree if you possess a complete diamond? Even if you possess a piece of the part of the diamond, it will become a wonderful ornament, and this broken piece of the diamond will not only become an excellent ornament, but it will be able to excel all other precious jewels. And still it will be recognized as the precious diamond, and it will be able to remove all the power trees. So similarly, what needs to talk about the great benefits of being able to develop all the instructions of the mind training within your mind. Even if you are able to develop a part of these practices, you will be able to bring about certain transformation within your mind, and you will, by developing a part of the meaning of the instruction being taught in this text, you will not lose the name of a bodhisattva. This means having developed bodhicitta, and then if you engage into the six perfect practice of the six perfections and so on, then there is of course a complete practice. And if you are able to undertake such a complete practice, then of course there will be great merit, and there is no need to talk about it. And even if you are someone who is undertaking a partial practice in the form of developing just the aspiration of bodhicitta, before developing the engaging bodhicitta, even in that case, you will be still called a bodhisattva. And you will also excel from the Sarvakas and the Pratika Buddhas. In terms of the lineage, you are able to overpower the Sarvakas and the Pratika Buddhas. And particularly, and you will also be able to stop the poverty of the samsara, as has been explained earlier. And it is like, this instruction is like a sun. And of course, with respect to the actual disk of the sun, there is no way the darkness can cover it. And even in those continents where there is the rays of sunlight, there is no possibility that the darkness can pervade in those areas. So similarly, what need is there to talk about being able to develop the complete instruction of mind training on bodhicitta within yourself? And even if you are able to develop a partial understanding of the meaning of the instruction, there will be no opportunity for the darkness of self-cherishing attitude and other secondary and root reflective emotions to arise. Now, if you have developed fully qualified bodhisattva practices, then in that case, even those negative deeds, which are said to be as negative deeds in the case of Sarvaka and Pratika Buddha, but in the case of a bodhisattva, because of his motivation and because of his total commitment to benefit all sentient beings. Now, for example, sometimes for a bodhisattva, there are occasions where he or she is permitted to engage in certain verbal negative actions and physical negative actions. So this is due to the development of bodhicitta. Now, partial practice here, for example, means even if you develop some qualities like loving kindness, compassion, and so on, this will at least help suppress the manifestation of attachment to one's friends and relatives, and hatred and anger to others. And of course, with regard to self-cherishing attitude, there are different degrees, and those self-cherishing attitudes which are found within a person who has not removed self-grasping, those self-cherishing attitudes are very strong. And whereas in the case of those that had removed self-grasping, their self-cherishing attitude may be weaker, maybe not so strong. This is what I feel. So whatever be the case, there is a self-cherishing attitude which is produced or induced by the self-grasping, which is the ignorance. And so this instruction on maintaining is also like a medicinal tree, because a medicinal celestial tree has the capacity to remove 424 different types of illnesses, and even the roots, fruits, branches and flowers of that medicinal tree also removes various types of illnesses. So therefore, what need is there to talk about the benefit of development of all the qualities as explained in this instruction? Even if you are able to develop a partial understanding of the part of this text, you will be able to pacify, or you will be able to purify many of the chronic diseases in the form of 84,000 different types of afflicted emotions. And particularly, Buddha came or visited at a time when the five signs of degeneration are manifest. And particularly this time is the worst period of the time of degeneration, where sentient beings, their main focus is development of afflictive emotions, and what they do is negative deeds and negative actions. And the tendency of the people is such that except oneself, whenever they see some misfortunes happening in others, they rejoice at it. And whenever they see good things happening in others, they become jealous, and that pains their heart. And physically, verbally and mentally, people bent on doing negative deeds to others. So such kind of disturbing negative emotions are felt in this world. And it is because of this, even those deities and gods that are the protectors of the teaching, and similarly the Nagas and so on that appreciate and protect the teaching, and the four retinues, four followers, and they also feel like moving to some other realms because of seeing such negative deeds in the human realm. And on the other hand, those that rejoice the negative deeds, like human beings or non-human beings who are very unruly and wild, their power becomes strengthened, and because of this, they try to send all types of inauspicious experiences in this world, and particularly they would try to obstruct and hinder those that had entered into the practice of the Dharma. And therefore we are confronted by a host of misfortunes, and at such a time, unless we make an effort in such a practice, which is the training of the mind, it will not be possible for us to achieve success in our practice. And having entered into this practice of the mind training, then you know how to transform misfortune into the path. And this is extremely important, because everybody knows how to use the favorable opportunity into the path. But it is in those times when you encounter calamities and misfortunes that you get obstructed and that you get discouraged. So when you enter into such a practice of the mind training, then you are able to transform misfortune into the path, and you will be able to see misfortunes as supporting factors, and in this way you are able to treat the obstructive factors as conducive factors, and such a person is really called a wise person. And if you are able to transform the misfortune into supporting practices, then you are someone who really has the potential and the capacity. And this instruction of taking the misfortune into the path is an instruction which invites the misfortune, which welcomes the misfortune on the path. And by taking such misfortune into the path, you get liberated from the dangerous misfortunes, and this way you'll be able to travel and move peacefully. And it is in this way that this human body will then become land of the bliss, because then none of the external and internal negative factors can make you suffer and make you unhappy. And this life, such a life of human beings, is also called the unperturbed realm, the unperturbed universe. And because of such an attitude, even if your body and mind is influenced by a host of sufferings, you will never get distracted and perturbed. And therefore, such a human life can also be called the city of happiness, the city which is the source of peace and happiness. And such a state is also called the state of actualization of a meditative stabilization, which leads to by which you are able to develop peace towards all phenomena. And therefore, so at such a time when you are confronted by host of external and internal negative deeds, and when the five degenerations are ripe, at that time, even if you make a small effort, then you will be able to accumulate merit quickly. And such a practice is more powerful than accumulating merit for countless eons in a pure realm. So this text basically has two parts. First is the preliminary practice, and then the actual practice. So first of all, you should come in the preliminary practices. The preliminary practice here refers to reflecting on the great meaning of this human life, how it is difficult to find, and how it is of great meaning. And it's, here you also reflect on the meaning of impermanence, that we are not going to live for a long time. So these are the preliminary practice. So first of all, you should identify how human life is precious, and how it's difficult to find, and how it is of great meaning. And then you should meditate on impermanence, of the fact that you will not abide here for a long time. And then you should meditate on the cause, karma, and their result, and then the faults of the samsara. These are the four points. So this order of explanation is different from Lamrim, great stages of the path, but this is exactly similar to what Tsongkhapa has explained in the three principal aspects of the path. And I here feel like explaining what I normally explain. These kinds of unthinkable benefits and merits that has been explained about the development of bodhicitta. The root of development of such bodhicitta is the development of compassion, as is explained in the Sutra Alamkara. If you have the compassion, great compassion, then you can develop bodhicitta, and in the absence of great compassion, you can't develop such a bodhicitta. So therefore, development of great compassion is the uncommon cause for development of bodhicitta. Now, in the case of development of compassion, as I said yesterday, we all have the potential. We all have this feeling of closeness to others, and we all have this longing that the person to whom you have that feeling of closeness should prosper, should achieve success. And however, the kind of compassion that we have right now is partial. It is based on ignorance. So what we need to do is to extend the scope of such a compassion. And by nature, all of us have this feeling of compassion and concern to oneself. And you have this feeling of concern and compassion towards yourself, not because you are so kind to yourself, but by nature we want happiness and do not want suffering. And it is because of this you have this concern and compassion towards yourself. So similarly, you show such concern towards your relatives, your parents, and if you again extend the scope, then you can extend that compassion to your neighbors and then to the whole world, and then gradually not only to human beings but to all sentient beings. And if you further extend it, then irrespective of whether you are directly seeing them or not, but you can imagine and think about the countless universes. For example, we can see countless heaps of stars and constellations, and all in all these stars and constellations, they do possess living sentient beings. So nobody can conclude and say that it's only in this human world where sentient beings live and not in other planets and other stars and other universes. So by taking the example of the human beings that live around us, that all these human beings and animals that you see around want happiness and do not want suffering. So similarly, how nice if all those sentient beings living in different universe systems achieve happiness and do not experience suffering. Now, when we talk about developing such a bodhicitta, then it is not partial, it is not biased, because you develop such a bodhicitta, you develop such a compassion with a wish that all sentient beings be without suffering and that they all meet with happiness, not because they are your relatives and friends, but because of the fact that everybody wants happiness and nobody wants suffering. So it is either your friends or your enemies or the evil forces which we normally identify as the most obstructive factor. If we sit down and think closely, then all these so-called evil spirits, forces or enemies, they are like ourselves, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Now this does not mean to say that there is no enemy. Yes, there is someone who is called enemy, who harms us. However, if we reflect carefully, such a person is identified as an enemy because of his or her way of life and her behavior. And therefore, it is important to make a distinction between the action of that person and the person itself. Now, for example, if when the enemy harms us, we do not mean to say that that person was an enemy right from the birth, but because of his or her particular action, you today see that person such harmful action as your enemy. And so long as that person continues with that negative action, you identify that person as your enemy. And as and when that person stops that negative action, then you can see that person as your friend, or at least as neutral and not your enemy. So therefore, it is wrong to see that person as something who do not want happiness or who want suffering. So without losing compassion, even when you confront an enemy, where you endeavor to stop the negative actions of that person. What you do is motivated by compassion, that you confront that enemy to help that person stop those negative emotions. So sometimes you might see it a kind of contradictory when you confront the enemy, thinking that how such a person who is practicing compassion can use such forceful physical verbal actions. But here it is important to understand that motivated by compassion, in order to help that person change his negative ways of life and action, you need to take certain forceful actions, but without losing compassion, without developing a biased mental attitude. So therefore, in this way, for development of compassion, first of all, we need to develop this kind of equanimity, where you do not have feeling of closeness to some and feeling of distanceness to others, by realizing the fact that all these infinite sentient beings are like yourself, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And even in the case of your enemy, from one point of view, the enemy is good for your dharma practice, helpful for your dharma practice. It is in this way, then you develop some feeling of closeness towards all sentient beings. Now, on the as the second step, even if you think about helping other sentient beings, first of all, it is important to properly identify the suffering by which all these sentient beings are affected. For example, take the example of a dog, a stray dog, who is sick and suffering from different types of physical illnesses. And then by seeing that, normally our hearts felt moved. And so when we see such kind of obvious sufferings, we develop some kind of empathy, some kind of concern. However, when we see someone who is slightly rich, or someone who is powerful, someone who is successful, then sometimes we develop competitiveness, and sometimes we are envious. We aspire, how nice if I'm also be as rich as him or her, or as powerful as him or her. So this clearly shows the quality of your compassion. Because if you reflect carefully, even the so-called successful, powerful and rich and wealthy people, they are not different from the rest of the people, because they are also under the influence of suffering of change and so on, and particularly conditioned suffering. And this being the case, all of these sentient beings, irrespective of whether they are poor or rich, wealthy or unwealthy, qualified or unqualified, they are all similar, because they are all suffering. And now, in the case of the three types of sufferings, the suffering is something that we all can identify. Suffering of change refers to those levels of experiences which we normally identify as happiness, but which in the long run leads to unhappiness, and therefore they are called suffering of change. And the suffering and the suffering of change arises because there is something wrong basically with our whole psychophysical condition, that the whole life is product of having projected by contaminated actions and afflictive emotions, and therefore these two types of sufferings arise from the conditioned suffering. So with regard to the Buddhist process of meditation on suffering, Penchen Lobsang Shujin says that there are different techniques. There's the wish to get liberated from suffering is there even among animals, and the wish to get liberated from suffering of change is there even among non-Buddhist practitioners. Not only they have that aspiration, that they also have a path and technique to get totally liberated from such a suffering of change. But in terms of freeing or liberating from the conditioned suffering, it is only in the Buddhist teaching where it identifies the these appropriated psychophysical aggregates. Oh. it is this appropriated psychophysical aggregate which right now acts as the basis for actualization of afflictive emotions and sufferings, and in the future also it will act as a basis for production of such experiences. So therefore, for a Buddhist practitioner whose target is to achieve liberation, it is important to correctly identify the meaning of this third level of suffering, which is called conditioned suffering. Once you have a clear understanding of the meaning of conditioned suffering, then you will be able to see that all this, all sentient beings within the samsara, they are all same, in the same boat. They are all suffering in that level of conditioned suffering, because whether you are rich or poor, wealthy or not, qualified or not, successful or not, we are all same under this suffering, because we have this tendency of seeing what is impure as pure, and what is impermanent as permanent, what is selfless as having self, and what is not empty as what is empty as not being empty. So therefore it is extremely important in order to genuinely develop such a great compassion, it is first of all extremely important to identify the suffering by which sentient beings are afflicted. Now, in order to understand the sufferings of other sentient beings, first of all you should have some sense of the sufferings by which you are afflicted. And once you are able to have some sense of recognition of your own suffering, then it will be much easier for you to show empathy and to understand the sufferings of other sentient beings. And when you develop a good understanding of sufferings of yourself, and then develop a wish to get liberated, then that is called renunciation. And when you develop a good understanding of sufferings of other sentient beings, and then you are able to develop great compassion. Now, when we talk about conditioned suffering, it primarily refers to a state of existence which is overpowered by afflictive emotions and contaminated actions. Now, the problem arises, unfortunately, because normally when we develop desire and attachment, we take it for granted that something is a nature of human life, human being. And particularly in the case of certain non-Buddhist practitioners, certain non-Buddhist people who may have no idea about these afflictive emotions, and if you tell them, try to reduce your attachment, try to reduce your hatred, anger and so on, then they would feel as if you are talking about removing the human mind itself, because they do not see anything wrong with hatred, anything wrong with anger, anything wrong with attachment. So you take it for granted and you voluntarily welcome all this, and in fact you feel that without these afflictive emotions your life is colorless, not attractive. And recently I read in a text, I think in the Sutra Alamkara, that in the case of the three afflictive emotions, again they can be further categorized as the extremely grosser level of afflictive emotions, and middle kinds of afflictive emotions, and the subtle types of afflictive emotions. So there are so many different levels in terms of their subtlety, and this kind of subtleties of afflictive emotions can be identified in terms of how they manifest within oneself, and how they are explained in terms of different philosophical systems. So what is really important is to identify these afflictive emotions and to see how they are destructive, how they destroy oneself and destroy others. So therefore develop a wholehearted understanding of such afflictive emotions. Now particularly in the case of yourself, you can understand this based on your own experience, how these afflictive emotions disturb your mind, disturb your peace. And once you are able to see the reason and develop an unchanging conviction about the destructiveness of such afflictive emotions, and then later on when you make an attempt and gain control over the afflictive emotions, then you are really freed, then you are liberated. That state of the mind is called liberation. On the other hand, if you think that liberation is a peaceful place somewhere up in the sky, where nobody comes to disturb you and so on, then that is out of stupidity. So it is in also in this way that you develop renunciation. The word renunciation here basically means the wish to come out of samsara, the wish to achieve liberation. Now, in order to develop strong conviction, thinking that unless I remove these afflictive emotions, it will not be able to achieve peace and happiness, and then there, in order to develop a convincing understanding of that, it is important to have an understanding of the cause-effect relationship. So from the point of view of cause-effect relationship, right now, even if you do not have any manifest sufferings right now, there's no really you should not get satisfied with that. For example, you're at present you're like someone who has received a strong anesthetic, and because of this anesthetic maybe you are not feeling those pains and sufferings, and this is a kind of temporary state. And even if you are free from any intense feelings of pain of the mind and the body, and because of that if you say that I'm fine, I'm okay, there's nothing wrong with me, then this is again absolutely wrong. This means you are very short-sighted and again very stupid. And this is important to understand, because so long as you have not removed the causes of such sufferings, sooner or later, today or tomorrow, all these afflictive emotions will arise and you will suffer. And therefore, you will then be able to develop an understanding that unless I'm able to remove all types of afflictive emotions, it will not be able to achieve long-lasting peace and happiness. Now, in order to... remove too much obsession towards next life, you need to remove obsession towards this life. It is extremely important to remove obsession towards this life, because we today pay less regard to what will be the consequence in the future lives, because we are too obsessed with what is in front of your nose, what you experience daily. So now what should we do? I'm not asking that now you get completely stupefied or completely lost, but what I'm all saying is that reflect on the nature of impermanence, reflect on the possibilities of change, reflect on the fact that you today possess such a precious human life, and it's in this way that you should, by reflecting on the preciousness of human life and impermanence, remove obsession towards this life, and by reflecting on the infallibility of the cause-effect relationship, you can remove obsession towards the future lives. And likewise, reflect on the faults of self-cherishing attitude and the benefits and advantages of cherishing the well-being of other sentient beings. And it is in this way you are able to develop a mind which sees all sentient beings as something very dear and close to your heart. And it is in this way then you are able to develop great compassion, which induces this special attitude, a special sense of responsibility, which then produces bodhicitta. So it's this kind of mind training is really like the internal instruction, internal construction of the spiritual practice, which is similar to the order of the construction that you do externally when you construct a house. So in order to have bodhicitta, you need great compassion, and in the absence of great compassion, there is no way you can develop bodhicitta, and this can be understood based on your experience. And in order to develop compassion, on the one hand, you should have a clear understanding of sufferings of other sentient beings, and you should see all sentient beings as very dear to your heart. And for that, you need to develop strong sense of renunciation. And for developing renunciation, you should stop obsession towards future lives and also obsession towards this life. Now, this process of explanation is slightly different from what has been explained in the great stages of the path, because in the great stages of the path, the whole process of the teaching is explained in a way so that the three individuals with three different mental capacities can be guided from one stage to the other. So in the case of the topics related to the small individuals, it shows a technique which primarily for achieving a peaceful way in the future lives. And when you move to the second stage, then it speaks about the practice of the three trainings for achieving liberation. So there, on the one hand, it develops a kind of appreciation towards that particular path, and even though the topics related to the three individuals, as is explained in the great stages of the path, should not be seen as isolated practices. These are all practices helping each other, but at the same time you will find that, for example, if you study the whole stages of the path related to the individual with the small mental scope, then it itself is a kind of complete kind of text for such a person who is able to do only that practice for achieving, say, happiness in the future lives. So anyway, these for the preliminary practices. Now from here until to the training and practice of the ultimate bodhicitta, when you train in all kinds of visualizations, then it should be done in two sessions, during the meditative session and during the post-meditative session. So this whole will be divided into two sessions, meditative session and post-meditative session. So right from the practice of reflecting on one's life as something precious, they should all be done by meditating in two sessions. However, it seems that instead of meditating, probably it differs from person to person depending upon their mental capacity. Sometimes instead of meditating on suffering of suffering, if you meditate on conditioned suffering, it may be more powerful and effective. So what I'm trying to say is sometimes instead of focusing on the particular topic of your visualization, if you sometimes meditate on some of the sections of the teaching that you find at the latter part of the text and then reflect again on the given topic, it will help you to appreciate their practice. For example, if you're someone who has a strong appreciation of bodhicitta practice, this will also help developing your practice of understanding of impermanence. So I feel that some of these lower practices will really push you to undertake some of the preceding practices as well. And of course, generally speaking, yes, the practice should be done stage by stage, starting from the beginning to the end. But what I'm all saying is that it should not probably be the case that you are not allowed to undertake any meditation and visualization on the subsequent stages of the practice without gaining experience in the preceding stages of the path. That probably is not the case, because even though I cannot make a conclusive understanding, but based on my own experience, it seems that sometimes when you reflect on some of the teachings explained in the end, some of this will help strengthen your preliminary practices. And generally speaking, with regard to explanation, there are different types of explanation. One which is kind of just a descriptive explanation, where the Lama explains the text from the beginning of the text to the end of the text. That is called kind of descriptive explanation. And then there is the experiential explanation, where the Lama explains as much as possible every day, relating to one's own experience. And then the student also, after the teaching, the student also does the visualization on those given topics. For example, in the seven treasures of Lungchenpa, in the instruction, meditation, or relaxing the mind, there are 140 cycles of visualization. And this 140 cycles of visualization can be done in a concise way, in a elaborate way, and so on. So you continue to do such visualizations for a week or so on. So that I would also call it an experiential explanation. And of course, you will not be able to develop genuine experience, but as and when you are able to develop some experience, then you move on to the next text. And in the Sakya tradition also, they have a tradition of explaining the same point four times. First they would make a more elaborate explanation, and then they would arrange it properly on the spiritual path, and next day they would again explain it, and so on. So whether it's in the Dhamdi explanation, the path and fruit explanation of the Sakya, in the past it seems both in the case of the teacher and the student, they would not bring any text. They would simply exercise their mind. But later on, the masters now use text. And according to the Gelug explanation, according to the explanations that I've received, in the case of the explanation of the solitary Yamantaka, that is done without any text, in the case of both the teacher and the student. And then there is another kind of explanation which is called where the Lama would explain a particular cycle of visualization, and then the student would simply meditate and visualize on it, as is done by Atisha with Lama Selingpa. I have one Lama from Dukpokaju. According to their tradition, they would teach one cycle of visualization and then let the student meditate on it, say for 1 month. And then after that, they have to offer their realization understanding to the Lama, and then the Lama would explain it. And then again, they would meditate on it for a few months. And then after that, if they are able to bring about some changes, then they would move to the next topic, next cycle of visualization. And there is such kind of practice even in the Gelug tradition. So when you train your mind through such a cycle of visualization, it should be done doing two levels, meditative session and post-meditative session. And in the case of the meditative practices, again it has three parts, the beginning part of the session, the actual session, and the concluded session. So it is in this way you train yourself how to undertake such practice during the meditative session and also during the post-meditative session. So meaning that you devote your whole 24 hours in spiritual practice. So the influence of the practice that you have undertaken during this meditative session should remain during the post-meditative practices. So it is really like a fire whose heat is never lost. So in this way, if you maintain the practice in this way during the meditative session and post-meditative session, then your practice will become very effective. Now during the beginning of the meditative session, for example, if your actual meditation is the preciousness of human life and so on, then now even though this visualization on the preciousness of human life is a meditation related to the individuals with small mental scope, but if you are planning to undertake a Mahayana practice, then during the beginning of the meditative session, you should influence that meditation through development of the bodhicitta. Now for example, this is similar like the meditation on kame biting or shamat. Shamat itself is not a unique Buddhist practice, but whether it will become a Buddhist practice or not is dependent on the motivation that you develop during the beginning of the meditation. So similarly, during the concluding part of the session, again you meditate on the six perfections, particularly reflection on emptiness, and in this way your virtuous practices will become pure and strong, both in the beginning, then in the actual, and also in the conclusion. So we have a short break here.